impact on London. London, of course, is a place full of people, households, neighbourhoods, which are generally at the extreme of the income distributions and social distributions of every kind. So hardly surprising, London is affected relatively more by many of these reforms than any other part of the country. And I just wonder, we've talked a lot about some of the financial impact on households and individuals, and I don't want to guide the conversation too much, but interesting to look, for example, at some of the spatial and social impacts that some of these financial changes may bring about, it occurs to me. The other question is, it's easy in events like this to attack the wicked government all the time, and I understand that. On the other hand, where the government is seeking to do things here, presumably, at least and the point was made towards the end by Alex, that the previous government has made efforts to do similar things. Are there other ways of doing the same things that would have a less baleful impact, if you think the impact is baleful? And the third issue, I suppose, is how far could London, this is begged by a question asked towards the end of the last session, how far could a London politics or London politicians go it alone in some imagined future world? And if so, what kind of policies might they pursue? And just some thoughts I have listening to the debate this afternoon. Who would like to make a comment, if so short, or a question, if so short? You can either direct to the esteemed panel or to have your night thoughts aired. Who'd like to have a go? Somebody must have a thought. Yeah,
okay, I mean, that's a question I didn't ask. That's for the IFS. So I've been doing some work with the London Equality Group, which is affiliated to the Equalities Trust, interested in the income gap and the breadth of income distribution itself being a social harm, and London being the most extreme in the UK. Is there anything you could say to IFS about the impact of all of these changes on the income gap and the relative gap between rich and poor? I mean, you said the rich are losing a certain amount of their pension entitlements. 5% for a household on a low income is, seems to me, intrinsically harder than 5% for a household on an income above 150,000. But overall, will there be an effect to narrow gaps between rich and poor, or does it stay the same?
And why not median and poor? Because we've all heard that report about the median. If the rich and poor are being squeezed in some way, are the median incomes and poor being squeezed as well, or not?
So what you saw from the chart was that within the, about the bottom 90% of the income distribution, if the tax and benefit changes act to increase inequality. But you've then got the very richest 2% who are losing the most overall.
household income impact is a real one, isn't it? There's a real impact on real household income, even if you see it as a qualitatively different thing that's going on.
Well, not today, isn't it? It's not an impact on your income today, is it? Because you've gone and thrown it in the pension pot. It's just that if you throw it in the pension pot, you're not going to be, as it were, topped up, so i.e. you haven't thrown it out of net, aren't you? No one whose tax relief is taken away in that sense is going to be worse off today. In fact, they might be saving money instead of throwing it in the rental property.
All right, that's enough. Not attacking the private, okay.
No, but
enough.
Yes.
And then one, two.
Just one to those things which we haven't talked about, which is age and particular problems young people are going to face in London. I mean, things like educational maintenance allowance, the removal of youth service provision, and if we're talking about inequality, therefore the distancing of a whole range of London young people from the rest of society, which has both impacts for them and impacts for us in terms of public safety, crime, and so on. And there's a dimension of that sort of social exclusion which seems to be a result of a lot of what you're saying and additional elements to it.
Well, James,
yes,
do you want to pick up educational maintenance awards and other things in these
So we don't model the effects of EMA in the things I've shown you before, and there's going to be some sort of replacement. We don't know quite how it's going to work out at the moment. I think you can certainly say that older people, pensioners, are relatively protected by a lot of the government's cuts to welfare. I mean, the state pension credit goes in line with earnings. Motives, but you know what the government of business is a fairly low wage
between everything that's been discussed this afternoon and the relatively high levels of particularly international, net international immigration to London over recent years. And whatever the impacts are that we're discussing today, clearly this issue will also impact on those impacts. If I can not.
And of course we've got restrictions on migration now.
Indeed. Okay, is that on the specific issue? No, okay, well then, there's two people waiting here. One, two, three. So, yep, you're on.
It's a question for Alex. I mean, I found your research finding so shocking because it brought these national changes right down to real neighbourhoods and real people. And I wonder if you could tell me what kind of plans there are for kind of launching the research and getting it to MPs in constituencies, because presumably this can be, this data can be kind of aggregated constituency-wise. How are you going to disseminate these quite shocking findings?
Can I add a rococo detail to that? Presumably MPs and other politicians will potentially react differently given their different politics. just a non-political thought.
We launched research in January. I mean, one of the nice things about working with Shell's reports is that they, it was on the research itself, do a lot of work taking it forward and producing it in their policy work and so on. And I know they've done a lot of work with local councillors in London. And I suspect there's a lot of quite varied responses. Why they don't believe it, but yes, I mean that's the answer. Is we try to do it in a more academic circle, but Rochelle's been doing some really excellent work using it to inform public policy.
Okay.
Probably particularly.
No, sorry. You all right? Go on, and then sorry. too many of you. Go on.
Probably direct to you, James. I mean, a lot of the things that we measure in terms of change to a financial impact, really, in terms of benefits. But in terms of poorer people, but much greater users of services, public services. And I was just wondering how you actually measure that, because the big cuts which have been happening in local authorities have been youth services, day centres, lots of children's centres going, despite what Frank Fielder said about them being important in terms of child poverty. Legal aid, for example, loads of that is going out of scope, so people won't have access to social justice. So are you thinking through the IFX as to how you measure that? So I think that would make it much more extreme, the gradient that you have that it currently is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something we at IFS have looked at, but it is a very important issue. I think there are lots of very technical, complicated conceptual issues to get your head around before you start trying to make a desktop chart, including things like public spend. I mean, the government made an attempt to do that in the annex of the spending review, but that's only looks at about a third of the cuts, I seem to remember. There's some work that's been done for the TUC by Tim Horton and Howard Reed, where they've attempted to look at how much particular households get spent on them by the different types of public service. But then, even then, you've got things like defence. Well, who's benefiting from that? Is that something we all benefit from by the same amount? Is it something that is just proportionate to income? I mean, whatever assumption you make is these are not innocuous assumptions. It's going to effectively determine what result you get, but they're quite a lot of these cuts.
And I think I've seen research done here in the past, John Hills and others, and Howard Glenister, who was here, has gone, may have done some of it, which kind of suggested, Howard still? Anyway, that suggested, certainly I remember at the time the poll tax was being introduced, research that kind of showed the opposite in some ways, that more affluent people used services more than the poor.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, somebody's saying yes now, right? Yes and no, right? Good. right. Okay, just as a, anyway,
I just wanted to move this point and also James's answer. This business of trying to understand these things in terms of losses misses an essential dimension of what is happening, which is the increasing risk. So one of these questions about what's going to happen to the economy, one might want to know the interaction between the LHA stuff and people in work. But even if they are in work, the real issue is if they are in work and are in private rented, the risks now associated with falling out of work are much greater. And however, one mustn't assume that these risks are just concentrated at the bottom. For me, the biggest single change in all these things is the removal of the entire restriction on contribution-based ESA, which is in effect the time limiting to 1 year of an earned entitlement for disability pension for a substantial minority. And that increases the risk for everybody in this room.
Okay, thank you. Now, definitely your turn.
Thank you. The question for Alex has been, obviously look within London at the changing patterns to 2016. So I picked up one interesting point earlier about concentration of low-paid jobs in sort of central West London. One thing you've done in your modelling of kind of outside London, are people by 2016 going to be kind of restricted to those four corridors that you kind of highlighted, or are there areas outside London that suddenly could become affordable for those paid workers travelling in, or are they already kind of in the unaffordable category?
I'm afraid, yeah, we stopped at the edge of the London rental market area, so it's a little bit wider than the. So we're looking sort of the beginning of the hinterlands there. I mean, you see my map a little bit bigger than the London boroughs themselves. But I haven't started looking deeper. I mean, I've seen places like Watford or something. You start looking at places, you know, where we haven't looked at any view on whether it might be affordable. But anyway, it's touching a pretty long commute and a pretty long trade-off between for low-paid work to get to Westminster from Watford. But no, I think it's a really interesting question.
Okay, right.
In terms of developing alternative proposals, have you made any estimate of the contribution that London's going to make to the housing benefit savings that these going to increase?
Yes, and I think I haven't got the working paper, so I'm feeling something like 30% of the cuts at the immediate point. I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was that. If you look at the measure, and that's not from my analysis, that's a sort of just building on the DWP's published impact assessment. So it contributes to about 30% of the savings.
John.
This is supposed to give Ruth something to do, and rather widen it a bit, which is connecting what Peter was saying early on with the London poverty profile, the good news of the improved GCSE or age 16 performance within London. There was a question earlier on about, well, what extent was that about composition change? I wonder if we could say a little bit more about, we've made it throw something in, but then could you connect that with just the general effect of everything we've been talking about and this kind of enclosure movement around inner West London? What effect that's going to have on what the way the inhabitants of that area behave towards schools? I mean, for a long time, a lot of middle class people in inner London have avoided the schools. But I wonder if you get the kind of income clearance that Alex's work points to, you then begin to get something very different happening in terms of the composition of local state schools, and maybe you get opting back in to those state schools, which then, well, we didn't want to expect their performance to increase. Now, I'm kind of speculating a lot, but I'm just trying to think of, steer you towards what might be the knock-on consequences of some of this for some of the other outcomes.
Ruth, do you want to...
just quickly, it's an open question whether the success of London schools is due to something that London schools do, and in particular the London Challenge claimed a lot of those successes, or whether it's due to the different composition of London's school populations, and certainly some of the work that we did, I did some work down at Sullivan at the Institute of Education, and we certainly showed that part of it is a compositional effect, so ethnic minority families on free school meals do better on the whole than white
did so carefully around putting it like that, and there you are. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, well, that echoes Mr. Johnson.
I mean, I suppose the test for this would be, are there areas of inner and central London which today broadly resemble what you're describing, where the retention rate amongst middle class households in local schools is higher? That would be a way of researching that, wouldn't it? Some parts of north, central and north Canberra would come to mind for a possible...
Wandsworth would be
another, yeah, where we would quite like to see, yes. Right.
I guess we could look at school change, but look at that over time, so not just areas which have had a static white middle class population, but ones which have gentrified in that way.
Some of this to me, though, which seems to me confusing or conflating ethnicity and diversity in class. I'm not at all clear what I think class is, like what drives people.
But I think it was embraced by your question there, wasn't it, John? I think I was the question.
I was thinking more about class than ethnicity.
Yeah. Okay, right, now, thank you, John. Mike.
I know you were first, I'm afraid, and this is quite...
Christy, you held the thread.
One of the things which is interesting to me in all this is the that we're treating the graduate sector as though it's one, and people are average and mobile. Well, in fact, we know that there are a batch of people who are extraordinarily mobile, and are always and some of those are very fortunate. They're actually going to benefit relative to the ones who stay stable because they won't be affected by the CPI. Because when they move, they get the new market determination. So there's incentive in that to move to
Hang on.
In trouble, the security of tenure was established by national legislation.
question, maybe we also need to reflect on the amount of continuity. Of course, there's issues like the real risk of an exodus, a displacement of people having to move from some boroughs to others. Of course, one recognises the power of that issue. But there's also a lot of issues of continuity in policy. And I think in terms of the impacts on the poorest members living in London, in many ways it's a continuation in a lot of the social policy, a continuation of failing to address the needs of the poorest members. We had a very powerful presentation that Tony sat in at earlier in the week on the impact on migrant labour. I mean, this is just one example. My real point related to this is that I found quite depressing the economic talk earlier on, because in my own mind I couldn't relate it to the issues of poverty and inequality. I mean, the presentation that's things aren't going to be that bad and we're going to be able to continue with growth and so on, I'm not sure how that relates to poverty and inequality. And it seems to me that there's a need to actually look at other ways of measuring quality of life, measuring what we mean by prosperity. All the information that we was given was GDP and the issues, for example, of environmental costs, just to give one example. It's going to become more and more important. And yet, how is this being measured when one only looks at measurements of GDP and gross income?
Can I just, fine, you've heard a long say. Treat that as a comment. I want to take one more point here, if I may. And we'll give a chance for others to come back.
So, forgive me, this might sound a bit naive, but are we going to see social housing landlords make evictions? And if we are going to see evictions, what sort of numbers are we talking about?
Peter.
I mean,
potentially, if people get into arrears, then they may have to. 70,000 in London was shortfall. I don't think the eviction won't be anything near that. Who knows? I mean, that was a stretch of estimate.
The majority of impact of all the energy issues is in the private sector, so there might be quite a lot of private landlords making evictions, but all of the changes that Alex talked about, almost all of them are just for tenants who are claiming benefit but renting in the private sector. So the only way you get social landlords evicted is because of the under occupancy changes at the moment. So I think there probably will be quite a lot of evictions, but they might not have been done by social landlords, who arguably work even better.
Actually, no question is naive in this sphere. I certainly love these things. Don't say to Peter.
Yeah, I mean, one thing on continuity and one thing on change. I think the thing on change, although even this is continuity because it really dates back to the 2008 thing, is the attack, and it is a deep attack on disabled people who are unable, even if they wish to, who are unable. Session in Scotland, where the conversation is not about child poverty, the conversation is around the situation of disabled people. Now, London has fewer proportionally, but I think the sort of the insecurities and the risks that we're talking about here, that is something that's new, not new to the coalition, but new post 2008, and that's a new dimension. The dimension that's not new is the very long term, and here I am now, my one answer to most. The long-term rising in work poverty, which has been rising for as long as your statistics will allow us to see them, but at least since the late 1970s, except for a golden 5 years, which is really the first 5 years of Working Families Tax Credit, 1999 to 2003. So I see nothing. It's probably going to be wrong. I can see nothing to think that upward trend in people being in low-income working households that anything will interrupt that. So there's a continuity of a long-term trend, but I think a disruption to the lives of those who are unable to get in the labour market even if they want to is probably the new ingredient.
Barrett? No? Okay. Can I ask one question from the chair, which I don't, unless it came up while I was out briefly, James. Council tax benefit reforms. Was that mentioned at all?
Yes, so...
You must have missed it.
What's the, is it, do we have any, I know